All right. Now we switch back into English. Actually, we're speaking English just for me. I'm grateful that you put up with that for this evening. I want to start just by saying thank you to a few people. First of all, to the museum here. It's really an art museum. It's quite an accomplishment, and we'll get to that in just a second. But it's really because of the open-mindedness and the support of the people here in the museum that we're actually able to do this kind of discussion, which is multidisciplinary and very much at the very forefront of gastronomy, but also interesting for art. I would like to thank Adam Mickiewicz Institute. Anybody in the cultural sector knows that without Adam Mickiewicz and the Institute and the Polish Cultural Institute, there wouldn't be a lot of culture going abroad. They're the lifeblood of our system, and there's a huge impact from this work throughout the world, and I know because I travel a lot and I see the impact that Polish culture through those channels has. So thank you very, very much for the support. And Kuchnia Plus. I've just finished with participating in the Food Film Festival with Kuchnia Plus. It's been a fantastic vehicle not only to showcase what's happening here in Poland, but to take the issues of gastronomy from around the world and the people who are dealing with those issues and bring them here and have an interesting discussion. And each time one of those people come, they again leave afterwards and tell stories about Poland and the scene here in gastronomy, which is very exciting. And this is another example of Kuchnia Plus through interesting programming, elevating the conversations around gastronomy. And finally, Smack Magazine, who through their publications and media channels are trying to elevate the conversation in gastronomy as well. So these are our sponsors. I want to say thank you very, very much for making this possible. We started this event about 10 months ago. I sat down with Sebastian Cichocki from the museum and thought, what would it be like to do such an event? And we sort of bantered around a few ideas. And Sebastian said, well, throw me a proposal. And so I threw him this idea about Poland's participation in the gastronomic avant-garde. And he kind of rolled his eyes a little bit, like, is it true? And so 10 months along the line, you know, I think there's points where I was wondering whether or not we were still in the avant-garde because it had taken a little while to get things rolling. But just for starters, there's only a few places in the world where an art museum and a contemporary art museum or a modern art museum is talking about gastronomy. I can list three or four off the top of my head, and in that context, they're talking about anthropology of gastronomy or the history of gastronomy. They're not talking about the contemporary issues of intersections between art and design and gastronomy. And so already, just by being here and having this, we're at the very forefront of the discussion in gastronomy, and that's exciting. So I can say that the job is already done about inserting ourselves into the avant-garde. But another reason why I wanted to do this event was because I think very often as Poles, we feel like our contribution inside of the rest of the world is quite minimal. I think we doubt ourselves. And it's simply not true. My wife, she's a titan of Polish culture. I am one of her cultural products, amongst many excellent others. But the work that she does introduces Polish culture to the rest of the world in a very exciting and interesting way, and people are hungry for more. And so here we put together three people who in some way are contributing to the very forefront of this discussion in the world, and people are paying attention. And so that's what this is really all about. Okay, so we're going to jump straight in. Breaking rules at the intersection of art and gastronomy. I'm going to have to move myself so I can push the button. The space where I work is really in between three disciplines. It's gastronomy, it's art, and it's science. And I come from a gastronomic background, but I love all three of these different disciplines for different reasons. And so I ended up working as a sort of translator between these different fields and trying to push forward discussion and trying to incorporate ideas to build collaborations. And that's a really exciting place to be right now because the barriers between these disciplines are starting to collapse. I just had the pleasure of going to Nowe Teatr just this last week. I went and watched Nancy, and if you haven't seen it yet, the work that they're doing there is really something special, and I think it's important that we support them in their productions, but it's still messing with my brain, this performance. So I was kind of thinking about Grotowski, and I found this quote by Peter Brook on Grotowski that says, "One of the vehicles which allows man to have access to another level of perception is to be found in the art of performance." And I was thinking about this in the context of gastronomy. Very often we think about the front of house of a restaurant as a sort of theater. We talk about the plate or even the table as a stage. And sometimes we go as far as talking about the food as a sort of actor. But we don't very often get to the conversation about the performance. And I think in order to do that, the food has to transcend the stage. It has to be an experience that engages all of the senses. And it's interesting that in the art world, it's actually performance artists that have been the first to engage with the chemical senses and these taste and smell and chemisthesis. So this talk is really about how can we transcend the plate and how does food perform? This is a slide actually slightly out of context, but I like to use it anyways. In order to understand the contemporary discourse in gastronomy, you have to go all the way back to Greek thought. And Plato actually likened the appetite, which was associated with a sense of taste, to a wild beast, which he chained down in the stomach of man in order to prevent it from interfering with your brain, the rational part of the human body. And so there was four reasons why taste was disparaged. And I've just realized that I've forgotten my notes in my bag. And so I'm going to come off the stage so I can read to you this quote. Okay, so first of all, taste offered pleasures which provoke overindulgence. This is a moral argument. It goes back to Thomas Aquinas and the seven deadly sins, where one of the seven deadly sins was gluttony. And if you overate, then your eternal soul was in danger of hell. But it wasn't actually just overeating. You could be damned to hell for all of eternity for snacking in between meals, saucing and seasoning, and eating with too much enthusiasm. And so I'm damned, for sure. The information provided was subjective. So that's the things that we're tasting, that we put in our mouths. They only tell us about ourselves. The immediacy of the object being perceived. That's that in order to perceive something by taste, you have to put it into your mouth. This was different from the sense of vision, which was deemed as objective because you could see things from a great distance. And the ephemeral nature of the experience of taste. That is that when you taste something, that the object is destroyed in the act of eating. These are the four classical arguments that have developed throughout art and have been revisited again and again. And inside of the context of art theory, the chemical senses of taste, smell, and olfaction have been rejected usually for these four reasons. Another additional reason is aesthetics, and it's the idea that the chemical senses lack a principle of order. And so if we look at the visual arts, we have proportion, we have balance and scale. If we look into sonic art or music, we have harmony and dissonance. But Adorno had a hard time to imagine what would be the ordering principles of the chemical senses. In fact, there are some that we're discovering recently through science, but that's relatively new. And then we're going to take one argument from gastronomy, and that's the idea of deliciousness. Deliciousness is often used as a hallmark of what is good and what is not, what is gastronomy and what is not. But it's also a biological imperative. Our bodies are wired in order to determine whether or not if something is delicious. So let's sort of set the stage a little bit here. Food is not art. Paint is not art. We can paint our freshly renovated house and we don't say that's art. In the same way, food is just another material. Can it be included in art? Yes, absolutely. We can build art with it. But it's not art in itself. And in the same way, gastronomy is not art. Gastronomy is the oldest of all of the cultural expressions. It was one of the first things that we did when we started to civilize ourselves was to cook for each other. We went into nature and started to select foods. It wasn't what we just tripped across on our hunting and gathering missions, but it was actually what we wanted to eat, what we decided was good. So it begs the question then, what is art? Well, it's a dangerous place to try and answer that question, I think. It's a very difficult question. But let's just start with this. Art is a philosophical language of inquiry that uses concepts and symbols in order to explore what Hegel would call the absolute spirit. That is divinity amongst us. If you want to take a more secular approach, it's who are we, why are we here, and what's it all about? And so art is a sort of language that explores those questions. If the chemical senses want to be involved in art, then they need to be able to speak in that language. So quick readjustments here. Let's not talk about food and gastronomy in this way, but let's actually talk about the chemical senses in art. So when we talk about art, we often talk about visual art. We don't talk about painting or photography so much as an art of sight. In the same way, we talk about sonic art. And so the correct way of addressing this problem is by looking at the sense that is the medium that's in, participating in art. And that, in this context, is the chemical senses. And where do these chemical senses come from? Well, we can go all the way back to the primordial soup that we came from, and before we had eyes and before we had ears, we had chemical senses. And this is how we navigated in the world around us. This is how we found food. This is how we escaped from danger. And this is how we found love. Well, procreation, anyways. And so these senses are all through our bodies. It's not only in our head. This is the starting place, and this is where we sort of recognize them, but it's through our throats, into our gut. Even our sperm has chemical senses and navigates this way. One final orientation piece is that in art, aesthetics, its time has come and gone. Aesthetics are important in as much as the packaging of the concept is important. But we've moved beyond assessing art in aesthetics, and we're talking about concepts now. It's the exchange of concepts. And this is a tripping point, I think, inside of gastronomy. Evenly, I just came from a conference in University of Gastronomic Sciences, and it was all about the boundaries between food, art, and philosophy. And everybody else was talking about the aesthetics of art. And I was a bit confused, because inside of contemporary art, it's not as important to talk about these aesthetics. We've had anti-aesthetic movements. We've addressed this issue. So the conversation needs to move forward. All right. Finally, food, right? So it's not the most beautiful creation that I've done, but it was an interesting one, because this was the starting place for me with food and art. This was a project that I did with my dear friend Oskar Davidsky, and he came to me and he said, I want to do a project that is involves food, and maybe you can help me to create this. And so what we did, we wanted to play with the idea of disgust. It was a beautiful collaboration, because both he and I came into this with two very different ideas of what we wanted to achieve. But we both achieved our aims without either of us having to sacrifice. In fact, it just became better as a result of this kind of collaboration. And so the idea was that we would present food, maybe some of you guys were even there, but we would present food that was relatively attractive to look at. It was aesthetically pleasing, but in the inside was distasteful. So the concept was hidden inside of the package. And so the idea of this concept is that if you look at the work of Paul Rozin, who is a cognitive psychologist, he talks about disgust as being an emotional, moral boundary between the cultured, civilized man and the bestial animal of man. And the closer that we get to this boundary, the more we're disgusted. And it's interesting is that in different cultures, different things disgust us. And so what this piece did, at least for me, I mean, you have to talk to Oscar as far as what his concept was, but for me it was about the idea that people would willfully play with this boundary, that they would take something that their body was rejecting and at the same time play with this idea and pass it along to their friends. What was interesting is at the end of this event, all of the food was gone. So, and so we celebrated this descent into bestiality. I'm going to give you one example from gastronomy, and this is a dish from Mugaritz. Again, back to the seven deadly sins. And this is an interesting piece because it also includes design. This design work was done by GRID, which is GR Industrial Designs from Barcelona. And each layer represents a different deadly sin. And so it's also a puzzle. It's playful. So once you take the box apart, it's almost impossible to get it back together. I'm not going to focus on all of these here because we don't have enough time. But if we just look at this one here, this is vanity. And so you're presented with a dish where you see the reflection of yourself. It's vain to admire yourself. And inside of this, you have a piece of chocolate. It was a beautiful piece of chocolate. And outside was covered in gold. And when you picked it up and you put it into your mouth on the inside, it was empty. It was hollow. And so in each of their ways, each of these dishes made a comment that was trying to communicate through the medium of food an artistic or an abstract concept. But it's not enough to have this kind of concept. It also has to be intended as art. And this is one of the biggest barriers, is that gastronomy has been mumbling around the edge of art for quite a long time. But intentionality in art is quite an important principle. And intentionality simply says that if you want to speak in the language of art, you need to place yourself into the conversation. You need to assert yourself. It's not enough to kind of mumble on the sidelines. And so here we have the classic example of Marcel Duchamp's fountain, which wasn't intended as art, but he picked it up and he put it in an art gallery and said, now it's art, talk about it. And it actually resulted in one of the most interesting conversations in contemporary art of the last 50 years or 60 years. And so here we have another dish, which is from Azurmendi. It's a beautiful dish. It talks about the Basque seaside and the memory of the chef from Azurmendi of the seaside. And you can see the idea of the water reflected in the glass on the plate. And the steam could be the mist that comes off of the Basque seaside in the morning. And it was fragrant, and it smelled like the sea, and it tasted like the sea. But he never said, this is art. And so it matters. If we want to talk about food and art, gastronomy and art, we need to present that as part of the criteria. So what does it bring? First of all, what do the chemical senses bring to art? Well, it realizes the dream of the symbolists, which was to have a multi-sensory art, to heal the artificial rift in the artist's body. And while the artists were quick to embrace this idea, and you can see this in the work of the futurists, you can see it in the symbolists and Salvador Dali, certainly, the theorists of art rejected it. They simply couldn't find a way to make it work inside of the context of art. And so this is really at the heart of my work inside of art, is to reintegrate the senses. If we experience the world with all of our senses, then art should be a reflection of that, and we should use all of our senses in art. It also brings new collaborations. It's exciting to see the tools that are being used in gastronomy and in science, flavor science and cognitive science, and how fun it would be for artists to be able to play with those. And what about the platforms that all of those institutions bring to the stage, art and science and gastronomy? It starts to become a lot of fun to play in this space, and new conversations. Where's food going? What's it going to look like in 100 years? We need to start thinking about these things because they're interesting conversations. I'm going to finish with gastronomy. What does the inclusion of art and gastronomy have to offer? Well, first of all, we need a new food critic. The one that we've been using is really out of date. If we look in the art world, we have to go back to the Enlightenment period, where we have Hume and Kant having this idea of a critic with good taste. So if a critic with good taste is a person who is gifted divinely, even with the ability to discern what is art and what is not art. And so he became the jury for that sort of art. And we've rejected that, and we've moved on to a far more interesting model. But in gastronomy, we still use this model. The food critic decides if it's good or not. And let me read to you. I was going through this dish, which I happen to know a little bit about, and reading the reviews of other critics. And so they were all pretty much the same, but here's one example. The second course is another finger food. The fish bones with nuances of lemon, garlic, and cayenne pepper are baby turbots. The look of the fish is a little bit irritating, the animals eating animals discussion in one bite. Whereas the taste is wonderful combination of crunchy fish notes with acid of lemon and a sharp ending. All right, it doesn't help me. What this dish is about is genetic selection. What is genetic selection? It's taking an apple from the Himalayas and putting it together with an apple from the United States and producing a third apple, which is our ultimate apple, our ideal of the best tasting apple, the best looking apple, the one that's the right size, the one that's going to sell the best. We can stick it in our lunch boxes. It fits perfectly. And we've done this throughout all of nature. You know, to find the boundary between where is nature and culture is very difficult now, because the more you look at it, we've terraformed everything. And so this is this discussion. It goes back to the idea that we used to go to the sea to fish, and we would bring in fish and bring it to our homes, and we knew not to take the small fish, because if we took the small fish, then there'd be no big fish. And so even now, we have a rule that says, a law, that we can't take fish that are under a certain weight. But these are baby turbot, and so how is it possible? Well, there's a fish farm that opened not too far away from Mugaritz. And they said, you want baby turbot? We've got lots of baby turbot. We'll never run out. You can take as much as you want to. And so the dish is actually called suspicious. And it's suspicious because it's forcing us, well, first of all, because the dish is a bit suspicious, eating basically fish bones as a meal. But it's forcing us to reevaluate our relationship with nature, to ask the difficult questions of morality and ethics. And that simply isn't covered in a conversation about the aioli and the garlic and the lemon hints. And so we need somebody who's able to take this conversation to a different level, that's able to mediate between the chef and the diner and facilitate a discourse and produce documentation and resources for people to learn more. We need a new research and development space. The restaurant is the worst place to innovate. I mean, this is changing now, and Modest will tell you about this, but in the restaurant, we're bound by constraints of time, efficiency, perfection. Any creative person will tell you that this is a horrible way to try and create anything. And so if you look at what the best restaurants in the world all have in common, it's a research and development lab like this one at the Basque Culinary Center. This is just a project kitchen. The space is vast. You have molecular gastronomy, cognitive research on the bottom, and many, many more. And so what would happen if we took the artist residency as a model and brought it into gastronomy? Would it work? It's something that I'm trying to do. I'd love to do one here if anybody would like to do it with me. Finally, we need to have a higher standard of learning for critical thought around food. Despite being the oldest cultural expression, it's one of the only ones that doesn't have a critical school of thought. And so we have this for art, we have it for music, architecture, literature. If you want to be an art critic, there's plenty of master's degree, doctorate degree courses you can take. If you want to do that in food, there's nowhere to go. And it's important to have this because food is changing. Our relationship with food is changing. The conversations that we're having around food are changing. What about all of these issues that we have? Global warming, GMO, cloning, and on and on and on. The food of the future, the food in space. I mean, these conversations require different paradigms than the one that we've been using. So I'm just going to close with this. We live in a time of integration. The whole world is integrating. Globalization is bringing people together from all different walks of life, from different schools of thought, with different paradigms. And so whether it's gastronomy and design and art, or science and philosophy and culture, we're all in this together now. And so we come into this with our traditions and our dogmas, and that's okay. What we need to do, though, is we need to hold on to the best bits of that. And we need to get rid of the rest. We need to make some space for inclusion. Because whenever there's inclusion and whenever there's different perspectives and a diversity of thought, what comes out of it is innovation and creativity and new directions. And that's what I'm really very interested in. So I'm going to pass the stage to Pan Marek Tsetsua, who it's a privilege for me to share the stage with, and he's going to talk about design.
Thank you very much.